extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here!
Wow, from New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time, driven by Continental Tire from the AT&T 5G Virtual Studios. I'm Andrew Wiebe with my partners in soccer, David Goss, Chuck D, Charlie Davies. We're back, baby! 3 weeks wandering in the wilderness, no MLS, well, one game of MLS. We've stumbled back upon the oasis that is a full weekend of Major League Soccer, boys. Viernes de Football, we got that. We've got a Union Atlanta United game on ESPN. It's like your Euro palate cleanser. You get the Euros and you get that. And Austin FC open up Q2 Stadium. How do you feel? Have you missed it? How are you going to spend the weekend? Do you believe that we are biased coastally? Because we have some mail about that as well with some actual data.
All,
how are you doing, Charlie?
We're about to do an episode about Austin, Texas, baby. You're welcome.
I'm not going to say I love the East Coast, and therefore I favor the Eastern Conference. But
your behavior reflects that.
My behavior might reflect that.
Charlie, what's your ESPN Plus game of the week this week?
New England Revolution.
Oh, my God. New York City FC.
Shocked. Never even heard of it.
I know. It's a shock.
Would never have imagined.
I don't know. First in the East versus fourth in the East. It makes sense. New England has to travel to New York City FC. Yankee Stadium, Red Bull Arena. We don't know. You know, right? I think when you look at this matchup, New York City.
Charlie's gone, dude.
He's just talking conference. I thought we were going to save this for the segment, Charlie.
No, dude. Once you let him into the Eastern Conference.
Once you go down the rabbit hole.
All right, I'm done.
We'll be back.
I've said too much.
Exactly. The producer and Andrew's reminder of the day before we get to a big show. We have Mark McKenzie. We have Jorge Chavez, who is a member of the Austin Anthem, going to tell us what that Q2 Stadium opening is going to be like on Saturday against the Quakes on Unimas and on Twitter. We also have Israel Solomon, and you're going to see some different jersey numbers this weekend in honor of Juneteenth to celebrate, to educate. If you don't know when I say Juneteenth, what that means, what it signifies, what the historical context is, this is your cue right now to go hit the Google machine and do some research on that. We'll also help you understand it in interviews with Mark and with Israel. But here's our producer honors reminder of the day, which is that we are true coastal elites because one of our listeners, also named Andrew, also in Kansas City, clearly a good guy, who listens to Sporting KC podcast, No Other Pod, sent this in to No Other Pod and then sent it to us about how we make jokes about how we're biased by the coast. And people say that I have a galaxy shrine, or I guess I say that. But this guy was curious how bad that bias actually is. He's been frustrated a lot, heard us wax poetic bits about like LAFC, Atlanta, Seattle, etc. He tracked every single team mentioned, every single one throughout the regular season this year. Every time we mentioned a team, it went into a spreadsheet, and his hypothesis that we were biased is correct. He ranked it here. We'll put it on Twitter. Of shield places by mentions, number one, Seattle. Number two, LA Galaxy. No surprises there. Number three, Inter Miami. That's both a positive and a negative for Inter Miami. LAFC are right after that. Let's see. We've got Minnesota. That's an Adrian Heath theorem right there. You have Toronto. That's a Josie and Pozuelo thing, as well as Armas. Philadelphia. Shout out the Union. It's the good teams. It's the teams with drama. So I feel, because we have mentioned every team at least, let's see, eight times, I feel vindicated. We do give out some...
Vindicated? Is this like a...
I knew I couldn't make one slip up here.
It sounds like you're throwing in the gate thing like this, a controversy. You've now created a controversy with your slip up. This is now vindicate.
Exactly. I was going to let it slide too.
Charlie. That's because you don't want to hear a gate because you're a Deflategate guy up there. You don't want to know about that. You don't want to get gates started.
Anyway, we have the data.
Official Weeby gate. I'm just throwing it out there.
We do have some good team drama bias. I will admit that. And it seems that revolves around the coasts. Let's get into it. We've got Jorge Chavez coming up.
Can I just throw out there that I picked Columbus to win Supporters Shield. That is located in the middle of the country. All of you picked LAFC doubles. So you guys are the problem, but I'm chilling.
That's fair. Fine. Look, we have Jorge Chavez coming up. We've got Mark McKenzie. We have Israel Solomon on these numbers for Juneteenth celebrating. And there's a ton of stuff on MLSsoccer.com for you to check out in the meantime. The call-up had Jonathan Mensah. Great conversation. Had his wife as well. They've recently been reunited after everything that they went through with COVID. Tom Boger has some great stuff. Five teams to watch in the summer transfer market and the lowdown on Jim Curtin's contract extension. Charlie Bohm has a really well-written piece on the beauty of the octagonal, the octagon, the ocho, whatever we're calling CONCACAF World Cup qualifying. Those schedules are out, so you can go check those out. It's going to be a grind. And the latest on Gerald DK as well. Let's just get it started. Q2 Stadium opening this weekend. They averaged a point per game. That's pretty good. They got to handle business at home, do Austin FC. The game's at 9 p.m. Eastern on Saturday. Unimas, Tudien, and on in English on Twitter. Here's our chat with Jorge Chavez. Here's what it'll be like on Saturday. It's an AT&T 5G call to the field. To Austin we go, to Jorge Chavez. He's an Austin Anthem member. And Jorge, I got to tell you, I have a beef against Grackles, but I'm looking forward to seeing what you guys do on Saturday. How's it going, man?
It's going good, man. It's a fantastic week, let me say.
You jumped on with us, and before we hit record and push this in, you were yawning, you were a little tired, and I know why that is. It's because you got to be at Q2 last night for this sort of grand opening for the U.S. Women's National Team. Tell us what it was like to be in that building.
I was there from the beginning of the city council, Austin City Council vote, when they wanted to use that site as a stadium. So it was very exciting to be from those harsh, you know, criticisms about putting a stadium in this location to not having to stand in the supporter section watching the, you know, I was expecting to be there on Saturday for the first game for Austin FC, and I'm still going to be there, but I was totally surprised and just really happy about being there for the women's national team being the first, and especially glad that the first, I guess you could call it, professional goal in Q2 Stadium is from Kristen Press, who is my absolute favorite player of all time for the national team. Not all time, for in the current roster, put it that way.
Tell me what it was like. Like, you walk into the stadium, are you goosebumps? Are you stunned? Are you able to, like, does it feel real for you in that moment? You've seen all these different steps, and it might have seemed impossible at some moments.
Right. The way my, because the season ticket that I had was for the supporters ticket, and to get to it, you have to kind of go up a few stairs, and then you have to look down. So it's like when you walk up, you look at the sky, which is open because of the stadium, but then as you descend into the top part of the stairs, you see the field and you see the TIFOs on one side for that Austin, the American Outlaws put up. Because I was not there early. I was there right as the national anthem was playing. And I kind of on purpose, I just wanted to get a feel of the crowd, the energy that was there. So it was exhilarating, very, very exhilarating to be there.
So I can say the same from home. It was loud the moment it kicked off.
Yep.
What's the feel like in the building? What's the vibe going to be like for games?
I'll say this because, like I said, I got there late, so I was walking around on the side, and you could hear the player introductions, especially Rapinoe when she was introduced as the lineup. You could hear it was loud, but it felt muted for some reason, and I thought, I'd expected louder. And the thing is that the way the stadium is designed, it's supposed to keep the sound inside the stadium. So once you get inside the stadium, it is really, really loud. So for the cameras and for everybody there, it's a unique way to build stadiums now.
Let's talk about Austin FC. Let's talk about the anthem and all these other supporters groups. Yes. They're going to make up that section and make this special. You guys have been doing, let's call them dry runs. I've seen some like chant practices.
Yeah. Yes.
You're going on the road. So you're getting those moments in, those reps, let's call them.
Right.
What is Saturday going to be like for these supporters, for you? What are you going to bring to this atmosphere? What should we expect?
It's going to be an explosion of happiness and not relief, because we already know what the stadium is going to look like. We know that we've been inside practicing and all that kind of stuff. Especially, just a little explainer here. There's three main supporter groups, which is us and Austin Anthem, Los Verdes, which are they're kind of the makers of the atmosphere, and which is La Murga. And La Murga is kind of the band of the supporters group. So both of us, kind of participate and help with that. And they're going to be the ones with the capos and the stands and all the music and everything. And so they're the ones mainly who the practices were for. And we've been doing this for years now. I mean, I remember practicing on high school soccer fields, and it was just five or six of us. And now there's 40, 50 musicians in that thing. So, and as for the practice, we got a little criticized about that holding practices in the stadium. But practice makes perfect, you know. Yeah. And we want it to be as good a show as possible on Saturday.
Yeah, listen, I make Weeby practices intros time and again,
and I still can't get them right.
Yeah. But I agree with you. Give us a pulse of the city, though, outside the stadium, because I've never even been to Austin, and I've seen so much of it from a distance. I got that vax now. I'm ready to get on plane. I'm ready to get some green and get some tacos as well. What is the city going to be like as an MLS city? What's the club meant so far early on for fans and non-fans in the city?
I think the city is starting to fall in love with the team. First of all, they've done very, very well. I mean, you can't for an expansion team to get 8 points out of 8 away games is very impressive. And I think it's just captured the love of the city. You go to any bar, any brewery, they're always going to show the games. You see people with stickers and with the shirts and all sorts of stuff. We held a watch party on the first kickoff game of this year. We had like maybe 1,200 fans, and it was still in the middle of COVID, if you think about it. So we had a big screen up, which is our bar. Home bar, I guess. Home brewery, I guess you could call it.
It's yours. It's yours, Jorge.
It's you your guys bar. Own
that.
Yeah.
I love that. 1,200
people. Yeah, that's yours.
It's all grackled out. And
oh boy, don't even say it.
And it's like maybe walking. It's like 6 minute walking distance to the state. You can see it from our brewery, and next door is Hop Squad, and there's like 7 or 8 breweries around the stadium that are just ecstatic about having Austin FC here, and But in general, it's just the atmosphere. I mean, our cry is verde listos. And a little quick story: I was in a fast food driveway, and I have stickers in the back of my car, so I'm waiting there, and then I just hear a faint listos, listos. Well, what is that? And so I rolled down my window, and it's a guy in back of me shouting at me listos. I have to shout verde. So we were there for a little while. That's just a little sample of how much, and the players are going are very, because of the COVID restrictions, they couldn't really be out in the community as much. But now with that, thankfully going down, we expect to see them a lot around town, especially the Spanish speaking players. Mm-hmm. I think they're very, very comfortable because about 35% of the city here is Hispanic. So I think that especially guys like that have been in MLS cities that aren't as diverse, I think they're going to be very, very happy to be here.
Pues somos listos right here, us.
Plus,
we're ready. Yeah. Good, but last one for you. We're talking kind of around these supporters groups, and it sounds like this is very much born of Austin. And of what the city is.
Right.
Help people outside the city, outside the supporters groups, maybe even within the city that don't really know what it's about yet. Help us understand what makes these Anthem, Amurga, Los Verdes, what makes them Austin? What makes you guys unique and just to your city?
I think what is really nice about the supporters group is that we get along well. I mean, a lot of the Los Verdes came out of Austin Anthem to form their own group. And so they're doing very, very well for themselves. But we still get along. I mean, I'm kind of tired because we spent all this week working on the TIFO, the first TIFO for the Saturday. And I mean,
Don't give anything away.
I'm not telling you anything away. I signed some stuff that I couldn't say anyway.
But, there you go. Legal.
Legal. Yeah, we want to really make an impact that first game. And so I've been working on that tee for until 1 o'clock in the morning, and scheduled to work on it today to finalize it and hook it up and everything. So, all the Murga has been busy, you know, making sure all the instruments are fine tuned and everything. So, but what makes it unique is that one of my fellow supporters from Los Verdes, Rigo Rodriguez, he said that we're not supporters, we're followers. And what the big difference is that you can support a team like you know, if you support the Cowboys or the Rockets or Spurs or whatever, but you don't see that many fans at 1 o'clock in the morning painting outlines of something.
You don't know what it is.
So, and guys practicing, you know, practicing and getting, you know, criticized for it. So it's just a community that's just different from any other sport, really. And what helps out in our community is that, you know, as been advertised, this is the first professional team in Austin, and just the diversity in Austin. A lot of us, I'm not from here. I'm from El Paso, Texas. So I've been here 15 years now, and it's a good mix of that same story, that people that just recently arrived to Austin or have been lifelong Austinites. The city is just very accepting as it is. So the supporters culture is very accepting as it is. So I think that's going to help a lot in the sense that we recognize that as people in the supporter section, we need to help the team, the players on the field with, you know, by being loud. You know, we admire places like LAFC with their 3252, Timbers Army, you know, all those teams that have all those fan bases that see the importance of their relationship with the players during game day, during the game, that, you know, it helps them. And we've learned from that, and that's what we're going to try to do.
The community's coming home, man. 9 p.m. Eastern, Austin FC, San Jose Earthquakes, Q2 Stadium. The MLS debut, of course, it made its debut on Wednesday night with the U.S. Women's National Team. You can watch this 2DN Unimas on Twitter in English. We look forward to seeing what you guys do. Jorge, thank you for joining us, man. Enjoy it. Get some rest. I know you got to recharge. You got a big weekend ahead of you. So get a little shut eye. Get on that TIFO. Make sure you stick to your legal agreements here, and we'll see what you guys pop up on Saturday night, okay?
Great. Thanks for having me, guys.
We got a taste. The U.S. Women's National Team christening Q2 Stadium. It looked incredible. The MLS opener, of course, is on Saturday. You can watch it on Unimas in English on Twitter.
Sounded incredible.
Yeah, it sounded incredible. It looked incredible. I can't wait to see how they sort of develop the atmosphere over time, because the first run-through is never going to be what it'll be, you know, a year from now, 2 years from now, 10 years from now. And what a matchup it is, too. Some chaos. San Jose coming to town. Mateus Almeida. And of course, Austin FC trying to handle business at home. What do you think about those stadium openers, in particular this one, Charlie? Like, what are those moments like? What does that mean to a fan base? What does it mean to those players that are going to take the field for the first time in Austin?
Well, for the players and for the home supporters, it's a new house. It's your home. You want great memories from this, as all your memorable performances, whether it's your kids or your kids' kids, this is going to be their coliseum. This is going to be a place that you bring your family to, that you come to enjoy the sport in your hometown, in your home city. I love it. I mean, the energy is always super high. There's that crisp new pitch, you know, that you always love to play on. And I just think that the design it just keeps getting better with each new stadium that comes into Major League Soccer. They're trying to one-up each other. It's like, I got to have the best stadium. No, I got to have the best stadium. So I'm super pumped to see it. I know the players, there's always a certain buzz within the locker room when you're playing in a new pitch. The locker rooms are always super clean and spacious. And I just think that it's just going to be so great for the league.
All right. Check it out. Full schedule. We'll get to that in just a second. But first, an interview with Mark McKenzie. A lot went on with him, of course, around the U.S. national team. A lot's going on with him at the club level, too. We've got a long chat for you. Hope you enjoy it. It's an AT&T 5G call to the field to Mark McKenzie's childhood bedroom. What's up, Mark? How's it going, man?
What's going on, guys? How you doing?
I'm doing good, and I see the offseason vibes for the U.S. national team. I see Serginho out in, I think, L.A. and, like, the trike whipping it. I see Tyler Adams in a supercar. I see you playing musical chairs, man. You're getting that quality time in with the family. I appreciate that.
Listen, man, everybody wants to go to Miami, Greece, you know, want to go to Ibiza. I'm just going to kick it here with the fam. You know, my sister had her graduation party this weekend, so, you know, I figured the best time, you know, to spend my couple weeks off was with the fam, who I haven't seen in six plus months. So, yeah, some musical chairs is always a good kickback.
Keep you grounded, right?
Give me the tactical approach with the family to musical chairs, because I saw varying approaches on the Instagram stories. Some people like to hover. Yeah. Over the seat. Other people like to keep it moving and try to get the person in front of them moving. How do you approach it?
I mean, I was a DJ just because I have bias because it was my sister, so I couldn't play. But how I approach it is contact is necessary, you know, at all times. You know, although it's not proper musical chairs, you know, in the rule books, whatever. You have to make contact with the chairs. You got to know where the next chair is at all times. You know, the DJ can pop it in time. So if you don't know your next move ahead, you're done for. And then you got to make contact with the person in front of you or behind you, because you got to create that space, you know, that elbow room. Mm-hmm. And as soon as that music stops, every man for himself. So, you know, you got to make sure you get stuck in, you know?
It's a little like playing center back.
This is the most balls center back conversation I've ever heard.
You got to time that hip bump just so they can't get the right lift. And then,
you know?
Exactly.
That's how it is.
Those are the guys that I just zoomed around.
Okay.
Let him try and body me or make contact. I'm going to just skip by real quick.
Exactly. Charlie was the one. He was moving the chair. He was moving the chair on you.
Yeah,
you were going to sit down. He was moving the chair.
Exactly. You're one of those guys. You know, you're one of the guys where I'm sitting, and as soon as I go to sit, I fall on the grass because you'd have took the chair 5 yards away.
You got to do whatever you got to do to win. That's it.
Yeah, I respect it.
It's a mentally tough game, survival of the fittest, only one person left standing. We're going to talk about so much with you today, whether it be Genk or the U.S. national team or, you know, everything that you went through after that game, and I'm sure have gone through otherwise, being racially abused, having the fans hurl some just terrible things on social media. I want to start, though, with the mental side of that U.S. national team game, because there is probably not a worse way to start that game for you than what happened, and yet you recovered. Like, in that moment, I was listening to Slices of Soccer, and you took Heath through all of that, sort of the mental journey you went on in such a short period of time. Looking back on that, looking back on your recovery, what stands out to you?
Man, I think it's just the – honestly, I think the speed at which I recovered, you know, I think that's probably the biggest thing. Because I know in the past, and this is me being honest, in the past it would have killed me for another, like, probably 10 minutes, 15 minutes, and then from that point in time, I would have already been in a deep enough hole where it's like you can't really get yourself out of it. I think I've matured in that way. You know, I think just life experiences over the past, you know, year and a half, particularly in the 6 months now where I've been away from, you know, my family overseas and whatnot, kind of been on my own, needing to make my way here in European football. I think having the mental toughness, the mental fortitude, the resilience to bounce back from mistakes. I think that's the one thing that I've improved on, you know, and that game was a moment where it's, you know, if you don't recover, Mexico is going to chew you out, you know, on each and every play. They're going to let you have the ball. They're going to, as soon as it gets played in your direction, they're going to pounce on it. As soon as you carry the ball, they're going to try and pick out any pass because they know you're not confident. You know, any 50-50 duels, these are all little mental games that they're going to discuss, you know, just like we will, you know, if the same thing happened on the other side, you know, you're going to look and try and find the quote unquote weakest link, you know, and then expose that. And if it's on the back line, you're right next to the goal, you know, and that's about it. You know, once you go up 2-0, you know, it's tough to come back. You need the momentum in order to dig yourself out of that. So, I think mentally the resilience to come back from that and, you know, that span of time, I think that was a big character building moment for myself, but a testament to the work that I put in just on the mental side of not allowing mistakes to eat you up for more than that second or that 5 seconds, you know, and moving on to the next play, because that's really all that matters at that point in time. You can't really go back and change the pass, right? You can always live in retrospect, but it's the past is always going to be in the past. So, yeah.
What was your first thought in that moment? And then how do you, like, practically, how do you recover from that? Mentally, it's a mental game with yourself. Like, you make the pass, it's intercepted, they score. I can only imagine what would flash through my brain.
Yeah, it was, did I just screw this up for my team? It's a 63 seconds into the match. You know, it's a final. It's already been the biggest game of my career, you know, at this point in time. You know, just not having an opportunity to put the senior team, which has been always been a dream of mine, you know, not to have the opportunity, you know, and to gotten a string of games, you know, to start. You know, I think that was big. And starting a national team tournament, you know, that's like, that's it for me, you know, that's what you work for. You know, and then in the final against Mexico, the rivalry that you see on TV and you want to be a part of, you give up a pass that leads directly to a goal in 63 seconds of the match. Like, what just happened? You know, everything that I planned in my head prior to the match just flipped on its head, you know, and of course, those things flash through your head. You're like, oh man, you know, what did I do? You know, this is it for me. You know, I'm done. National team, I'm done with. You know, this is my chance. My opportunity's gone. And then I had to stop and I said, look, this is football, right? And at the end of the day, we can plan and we can work so hard, and things sometimes don't go as planned. You know, so I need to snap out of this. So that's when everybody kind of, you know, Zach, I was like, hey, let's go. You know, and at that point, I kind of stepped aside and just took a knee, said a quick prayer. You know. Kobe, like, you're good, you got this, you're here for a reason, you're built for this moment, you're built for this. And then shake it off, take a deep breath, and then we get back into it, you know. And I think at that point that was like, you know, just flushing it.
So for me, you're in the same situation in World Cup qualifying to start the game. Is it I'm lumping this thing forward, or is it I just got to execute that pass better and I'm not afraid to play short? Or did Greg say, hey, I know we want to play short, but against Mexico, a game like this, let's just play it into space. What? How do you approach that next time?
Yeah, I think we can discuss it before the game of what to do, you know. But you kind of have to read in the moment, you know. The football, these things, they pop up on the fly. You know, you can plan for one thing, and then the complete opposite mm-hmm. happens. You know, as I learned, in that moment, in the heat of a final, when they're high pressing and they're full of energy. And I go back and do it again, I'm lumping that thing 60 or 70 yards, you know, even if I kick it out of bounds, you know, give the team a chance to recover, get our shape again, you know. And World Cup qualifying, if we're in a way, you know, and the pitch is crazy and there's crazy bounces and this, that, and the other, just lump it, you know. There's nothing wrong with that. Priority as a defender is to defend, right? You know, mm-hmm. So as much as we want to play pretty soccer and guys can get pissed off, oh, what are you doing? Why'd you lump it? You got to do what you got to do, you know, sometimes, you know, that's what football calls for. So, you know, yeah, going back, I take a touch and blast that thing, right, you know.
To be honest, I never, as a player, I never wanted backs to be on the ball.
Yeah.
Get that. If you can't get it to a midfielder, just put it down the pitch, put it in the channel. I'll get to it.
Oh, yeah, of course. Exactly. Yeah, that's where it goes. Yeah, yeah, put it in the channel. You know, hey, look, don't even worry about it. Just put it in the channel. We're all going to be good.
In the channel. It's not
out of bounds. It's into the channel.
In fairness, Charlie, no one can play on the ball like Mark did that you played with. No offense to Gooch. No offense to Boca. It's different now. It's a different game.
Yeah. It's different. It is different. But you know, I think in that moment, I put it into the channel, you know, and just let us step up, squeeze the lines, not put them under pressure, get our shape. You know, and really fill out the game some more, because that ultimately kind of put us on the back foot to start the match a little bit. So, yeah.
You said that this is the dream, Mexico final senior national team. Taking away that moment, the rest of the experience, the way the game played out, the feeling on the field for you, watching it happen, being a part of it, did it live up to what you thought it would be?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Had everything you could have wanted. You know, everything in CONCACAF you could have wanted. You
know, you see or didn't want.
Or didn't want, honestly, you know. So we're not going to get into the technicalities. But yeah, it had the goals. It had the intensity. It had the fights and the flair. It had the goals. It had, you know, it had what you wanted as a spectator, one. You know, and as a player, of course, as a defender, I don't want that many goals. You know, that's, you know, for my team, yeah. But conceded against, no. But look, it was a rivalry, right? And both teams were fighting, you know, and this is the first, I think, yeah, really the first time we've met up since a Gold Cup final. Was the Gold Cup final, yeah?
Certainly, there was the one Miazga.
Yeah, I think it was, yeah.
With the height measuring game.
Yeah. That was that game, yeah. So it's a lot of emotions built up for that time, you know, and to finally, after a year of COVID and not uncertainty with everything, and now having an opportunity to really go head-to-head with each other, you know, with all the anticipation. You know, I think that's the, you know, you really got to see it. So, yeah, definitely lived up to everything that I could have wanted. Now it's maybe going to Azteca and competing there.
I mean, we don't – Charlie's here. Hold on. We'll let him get to it. We'll let him – the more things change, though, Mark, the more they stay the same with U.S.-Mexico in particular. And this one felt – for fans, and I count myself certainly among them, just like this bonfire lit on what is this sort of, at least in CONCACAF terms, like kind of the ancient rivalry, you know what I mean? The one that has it all. I'm not sure anything gets me more jacked up other than the goals than to see you guys go into sort of these like mano a mano, a little bit of scuffle pushing matches and be up behind each other 100% when you're watching it. And I know the whole fan base was feeling it. It's just like, yeah, let's go. We're here. I mean, what did those moments feel like? What did the rivalry feel like? And who is the number one Ishhauser on the team? Kellen Acosta was getting it in on that PK. Of course, Weston is in the mix. Like, who embraces those moments the most, you think?
Man, okay. All right, so to the first part, yeah, it was like, yeah. It was something, too. It's like a new school edition of the old school rivalry, you know, with the young kids on the block, you know. And there were so many questions about, you know, do we have the fortitude? Do we have the edge, you know, to kind of deal with this Mexican team that's been together for a while? And yeah, they have this, that, and the other, you know, and everyone calls, oh, the U.S., they have a bunch of, you know, really good individuals. You know, what do they look like as a group? And I think really getting together, I think that was a telling moment for this team, you know? And yeah, it was special, you know, for all of us. You could tell just the feeling in the match, just the conversations we had on the pitch. Yo, I got you, yo. Next play, yo, this, you know, this, that, and the other. These are just little things that go on, you know, and it's like, we understand, like, it's not going to be pretty, but we got to roll up our sleeves. We got to get gritty, you know? I think that's what made it, you know, that much more special for me as a player and for each other, just knowing we had each other's back. Now, for the Ishhauser, yeah. Let's see. I think that...
John Brooks is underrated here too.
John in the Honduras game. John was underrated in that he kind of set the tone, you know, in that match. And I think they were trying to get under John's skin a little bit to start the Mexico match and feeling like, oh, you know, with that early yellow card and trying to get the ref to call, you know, this, that, and the other, you know. But at that point, like, yo, John, don't worry, I got you, bro. Don't worry about it. I think it was probably Weston. Weston was up there for that Mexico match. Just because he's one of those guys. He likes to talk. He likes to, you know, get into it a little bit. He doesn't mind a little bit.
He's got the Clint Dempsey facial expressions too.
Yeah.
He's very emotive on the field. You know, he's not, you don't have to guess with Weston what he's feeling.
I think Wes is up there. Kel was getting in there. DeAndre was ready. DeAndre was, he wanted all the smoke. He wanted all the smoke. He was ready for it. It was the Mexico U.S. Robert. He wanted all the smoke that game. And I can go down, there were countless.
It's all you.
Yeah, you know, I think as soon as it sparked, it was like, yes, 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 let's go. You know, and now you can finally get in there. So
one of the iconic moments, obviously, is Gooch staring down Borgetti. And that, Charlie, you know better than me. I assume that wasn't in the moment. Like, you're prepping for that game. That's the matchup he was waiting for that he wanted to win. Did you have someone on the other side that you were like, that's my job, and that's the guy that I want to dominate, the guy that I want to prove that I can be better than?
Okay, Chuck, go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, from my standpoint, when I got that first crack at Mexico and Azteca, there wasn't an individual that stood out to me. I just said, I got to do my job. This is a game I've always dreamed of. This is the ultimate matchup. Come in and make a difference, make an impact. Yeah. And we were coming off the Confeds Cup, so, you know, we were riding high. I feel like now for you, you go to Azteca, you beat them in Denver at altitude, so that altitude is not going to be an issue now because you've faced it. Now with the fans, you got a little sense of it as well because it was probably 80% Mexican fans in if not more. Put that on steroids, that's Azteca. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You got a glimpse of it, a taste of it. I feel like it couldn't have been a better scenario for you to get that experience in Denver against Mexico at altitude for the World Cup qualifier when it takes place in Azteca.
March 24th. I'm just gonna throw it out there. 2022. Put it on the calendar. Put it on the calendar. Somebody needs to do the stanky leg in the corner if they score. I'm just saying.
Listen. I think that for me going into the match, it was just ultimately about doing my job. You know, it was my first final, you know, with the national team. I think coming in just with the mentality of what do I need to do for the guy to my left and my right, the guy in front of me, behind me, in order for them to succeed, you know, and from there, what do they have to do in order for us to succeed, you know? So now it's just about, it's a domino effect in a way, you know, that's what we talk about. Everybody do their job at a high level and we'll be fine, you know? And again, it may not be pretty, but as long as we win our duels, as long as we handle the matchups, you know, in the time, you know, as long as we know our roles, then we'll come out on the better side, you know, hopefully. You know, sometimes football isn't like that, you know, it's not fair, you know, things don't go your way at times, but we do our jobs and we'll be happier, you know, with the end result. So I think I don't necessarily, of course, you see guys like Lozano, you know, Tegatito, you see Acuña, who I played against LA Galaxy. So, you know, their attacking front is quality, right? You know, Hector Herrera in the midfield, you know, we weren't sure if Guardado was going to play in the midfield. I think you see their quality. So it's about what do we need to do to shut them down? You know, what do we need to do to keep them quiet? And that was just the mentality going in. So I wouldn't say there's a specific person that I had in mind in terms of I need to shut you down, because although I can shut him down, you know, there may be another guy who's on fire, you know? So now it's like, I'm putting all my effort and energy into shutting this guy down and my boys, you know, on the bigger roles that we have. So.
Well, to be honest, I'm not going to lie. Looking at the striker position for Mexico, it was weak.
It was. They didn't really have a nine.
If you had Raul Jimenez, now we're talking about a challenge for you as a center back. But exactly. Not Henry Martin. I mean, you could play with your shoes untied.
Wow. Now we're shoes untied, slagging Henry Martin in here now, Charlie.
I'm just saying there wasn't quality there. Chucky Lozano is one of the best players in his position. I would say he in the world. He is fantastic. And but as he's a winger, and yes, exactly. He'll come inside, he'll stretch, but that's not the player you're going to be battling it every time in the air. Raul Jimenez, even a Chicharito, if he all of a sudden got called in, are players that you're really matched up 1v1.
Right. So yeah, again, these are guys who are kind of playing that false nine, you know, kind of pulling wide to make runs in behind you. You know, as soon as a guy, you know, has time and space with the ball and turns, you got to check your shoulder because, you know, he's coming in with this cross backline run. So yeah, I think if it was Raul Jimenez, you got your hands full because he's so dynamic, he's strong and hold up, but he's also lethal in the box. So, you know, that's a different thing. You know, even if Alan Pulido, you know, if he started, it'd be a different kind of matchup on the day. So.
Let's talk about World Cup qualifying before we move on to the negative side of all this. I'm looking at the schedule here, these three game windows. Wow. I mean, that's going to be hard, just physically, mentally difficult throughout the entire time to get to the ultimate goal. I mean, this is what it's all about. It's what we've been building towards. What has Greg said about this cycle? What do you think of when you look at this and see, like, in, you know, six days, you got three games and they're really all must wins ultimately?
I think we, this window here, this
the
past,
entirety, you know, of it, man. All
yeah,
of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think going through the camp, this previous camp with the team, I think we tried to, Greg wanted to replicate what it would be like to travel. You play a match on a Sunday, you know, with your national team, to then travel across, you know, the Atlantic to come to, you know, States or to come to whatever it was, or wherever it was, to then have a couple of days to kind of recover, train, get adapted, to then play a match 2-3 days later, to then travel again to play a match 2-3 days later, to then travel, you know, again to play 2-3. I think that's what he wants to replicate in this window. And guys kind of got to feel what it would be like, you know, to make that journey, you know, from domestic football, or even when we play Switzerland as a national team, you know, going from Europe to States and to learn what it would be like to adapt on the fly. It gave us a good taste of what it would be like and how guys felt, how guys would manage their bodies, how guys would, you know, manage the load and whatnot. So It gave us a taste for it. Again, you don't know because qualifiers just has a different feel to it. It's World Cup qualifiers and everybody's fighting. And all the nations league, you know, it's the inaugural tournament. And, you know, it's tremendous, you know, honor and everything of that nature. You know, we got to the trophy of World Cup qualifiers. Only a few teams go to the World Cup, you know, out of our region. So it's every man for himself. It's a dog-eat-dog world. You're going to environments where, and I haven't, I've been to a couple, but at the senior team level, it's just different, you know. And I said that on slices, but it's just different. It just has a different feel to it, you know. So when you do go to Honduras, you go to El Salvador, or you go to Trinidad, or you go to Jamaica, you know, these are environments that are just different. You know, the pitch may not be great. The conditions, it's going to be hot. You're going to play at 3 o'clock in the afternoon in the Caribbean, which for those who haven't been to the Caribbean before, and it is a sauna in the afternoons. The sun is beating down on you. It's humid, you know? So these are all different conditions and factors that you had to put into play. And they still have to go out and compete against 11 guys who are also wanting to advance to the World Cup. And then you got the referee, you know, you got, you know, these different tag, you know, all these different factors that go into it. So I think mentally we all have to step up, you know, take things to another level. You know, as soon as we come together, realizing this is going to be a gritty, gritty process, and it's going to be one match at a time. We can't look ahead to, oh, okay, we got Honduras, so we're going to go. We got, you know, Costa Rica next week, so, you know, we just start preparing. Nah, we got Honduras today, we got Honduras tomorrow, and we got Honduras until we have to prepare for Costa Rica, you know? So that is the mentality that I think that we need to keep, you know, in order to be successful in this process, because it's tough with three games in a week span, you know, 9 days. So
you mentioned that experience in the Caribbean. Obviously, every game's a big game, but you have family in Jamaica. You obviously have a connection there. Have you thought about what it's going to be like to play against them in a big game, what the emotions, what the experience will be like?
Yeah, I mean, I already got Andre Blake messaging me trying to play my games, you know, so that's my boy, you know, love Dre, you know, but I got family, you know, I got ties to Jamaica, so it's different, you know. And ultimately, all my family's happy to see me playing with the national team, playing football at the highest level, enjoying my game, you know. But again, you go back to the land my pops was born in, I spent time in, I got family there. So it's, yeah, it's one of those special moments, you know, that you get to kind of go back and reminisce on some times, you know. I remember getting mosquito bites, you know, and I had a big old, I was like six, I had a swole, I had a big old mosquito bite on my head, you know. So, Yeah, it was bad. You know, mosquitoes out there on steroids. So, you know, just little moments like that, you know, that take you back.
A whole lot of blip. Yeah.
exactly. So, yeah, take you back to those moments. You reminisce a little bit. But ultimately, I'm there to do a job, right? You know, I'm there to help my team qualify, you know, and advance, you know, and qualify. So, it's great and all, but at the same time, you know, I want to see my team win. So.
That's the goal. Zach Steffens on this show said you guys are looking to do something bigger, and we're all behind you in that sense. You mentioned your family. We've talked about the positives here. Let's talk about the negative. I thought it was really brave of you, one, but also you showed immense strength in the moments after that game, because it was a game in which you made a mistake. It was a game in which it might have been easier for you afterwards, you know, being racially abused on social media. We heard the chants coming from the stands in those videos. It might have been easier to be silent, Mark. Like, to just sort of push that down the road, and you weren't. You stepped out earlier in your national career and said, no, unacceptable, can't happen. This is what happened to me and my family. Talk us through those moments for you of seeing those messages, of that moment in your life where you had to make a decision. What am I going to do right now? And then the decision that you made.
Yeah, it was one, because everyone, you know, a lot of people know me. I'm not very confrontational, you know, in the sense I stand up when I need to stand up, and I step back when I, you know, when I think about things prior to making, you know, an action. So it was one of those moments where, as a footballer, I knew I made a mistake. You know, I made a couple mistakes in that match. I won't deny it. You know, I'm not perfect. It wasn't my greatest match ever, right? But at the same time, this is football, you know, and that happens. So I'll learn from it, and I can take critique. I can take the performance critique. I can take that as a player. But when you start crossing the line of attacking my family personally, you know, you start racially abusing myself, and my teammates got it as well. You know, when you cross that line, now you're going from critique of performance to trying, you know, and I said it before, but now you're trying to degrade somebody, you know, make them feel inferior, you know, on the way, you know, verbally. And people say, oh, words, you know, words, you know, six of stones, you know, break my bones, but words aren't this, that, and the other. You know, but words sometimes they hit you a little bit, you know. And I don't think it hit me in a way where I was upset or sad, but I was more annoyed at the fact that we're still dealing with the situation, and I think it needed addressing, you know. It did need addressing, you know, and still needs addressing, you know. We still have instances where, for example, England's national team is getting booed for taking a knee. These are instances I'm like, that's exactly why, you know. But for me, it wasn't about attention. It wasn't about taking away attention from the match or my, you know, what happened. It was more about bringing attention to the fact that this is prevalent. You know, this is, yeah, they attacked me, but at the same time, we can't let our guard down at any point because this is still going on, you know. And I think my family, my teammates, they were all supportive of me saying something, you know. And I battled with it because, again, my team just came off a successful, you know, the first inaugural trophy. You know, and I did not want to take away from that. But there are things that are bigger than sports. There are things that are bigger than just me. There are things that are bigger than the team. And I felt that this was needed to be said, you know. And I took a few days to kind of, I took the log off everything just initially to kind of just reset a little bit and kind of clear my head. As I didn't want to allow my emotions to charge my response, you know, because I was angry, you know. Yeah. Somebody coming to my family. You know, kind of, you know, again, you can come at me, but my family, you know, people talk about my mom, my sister, you know, it's, I would go into what they were saying, but it's just like, it charged me to the point where I wanted to respond right away, you know, and now you put yourself in a predicament, you know, in a situation now if you do. So I just shut everything down, kind of logged off, enjoyed the moment with the team, you know, and took the next day to really process, you know, what I wanted to say and how I wanted to come across. And that's when I put out the message, you know, that evening. I think it was Monday evening. And everybody was extremely supportive. The messages I got of support were numerous, you know, and I can't express my appreciation, you know, for that. But I think this was a moment where it was bigger than the game, you know. And I'm a young player, and I'm just starting my national team career, really. And, you know, I'm just making a jump to Europe. But at the same time, I have a platform, you know, and this happens on a daily basis. You know, this isn't the first time this has happened to me, but it's the first time I've really spoken up about it in this way. And I think that's why it was such an important moment, you know. A lot happened, but at the same time, I'm glad I did say something. And, you know, I can't thank my teammates, my family, friends, and a number of people who expressed their support, you know, for the messages, because, you know, it gives you that feeling of like, yeah, I can do this. The confidence to go out and really continue to push forward. Because ultimately, we had a game in 3 days. You know, I didn't know if I was playing or not, so I needed to mentally be in a state. You know, I had to brush off the last match, brush off the mistake, and step into that match ready to be successful with my team. And in that moment, you know, let it happen. Yeah, it's still there. Yeah, still get messages, but we need to remain active. You know, and not just looking for hashtags, you know, to jump on the bandwagon of, you know, this is something that on a daily basis we need to stay aware of, you know, because it's a reality, you know, of being a Black player, you know, and being a player of color, you know, and I'm one of many who this happened to. So, yeah, that's kind of my take.
As you think about the action side, which I think is the side that we all should be thinking about, you know, we're going to talk to Israel Solomon here in a second, and he designed the Juneteenth numbers that are going to be on the back of jerseys this week, mm-hmm. and there's going to be an auction and support on the charity side, and there is there's more awareness around Juneteenth. But on the flip side of that, awareness doesn't necessarily equal progress. Mm-hmm. And I think we see that politically, we see that in policy, we see that in moments like these where there's still this prevalence, as you said, Mark, and I thought you said something really interesting on Slices of Soccer, which we'll get to in just a second, which is what's the next step? Like, when you think about the next steps, and maybe we can talk about just soccer, or maybe we talk about the world at large, like, what are the next steps? How can we truly target and eliminate, hopefully, maybe that's not possible, but minimize, bury as deep as we can, this hatred that's very real in our world?
Yeah, I think that's a you know, a really deep question, because I think it starts, you know, with individuals. You know, I think that's, it's something inside, you know, that something that triggers, you know, a moment like that. You know, we talk about, for example, social media and how it's such a big, it's a huge, huge resource now, you know, in this world that we live in, you know, where you can connect with people all across the world. You can build network relationships. You can build brand relationships, that and the other, you know. But on the flip side of it, it gives people a feeling of power. This feeling, you know, this feeling of, I can say this and nothing's going to happen because, oh, what, I'll get blocked and I'll create a new account. You know, and this is where I feel like we have so many different ways of going about shutting people down, you know, in a way. And I'm not talking about, you know, cancel culture, but I'm talking about when you start trying to attack people, you know, on this personal level, what are steps that can be taken? And yeah, you see it time and time again where people can create brand accounts and there's process that go on and whatnot. So I think that's a difficult one, you know, but it's important to remain active on that front. But in terms of just in society, you know, we talk about Juneteenth and how it's kind of just getting recognized, you know, over the last year now, that you really start to hear more about Juneteenth, you know. But on that front, you look at it and what's being done in the classroom, you know, with kids. I didn't know about Juneteenth coming up in social studies and history classes. I didn't know about it until, you know, I had my cousins and whatnot trying to tell me, start introducing me to it, you know. So when you talk about people learning about it, if you're not learning about it on a daily basis, you know, in the classroom, we talk about, you know, American history. This is American history, you know. This is a huge part of American history that we have just skipped over, you know. Mm-hmm. We talk about the generic, the basic facts, and, you know, we always talk about the Civil War. We talk about Abraham Lincoln, the Emancipation Proclamation. Yep. We talk about, you know, this, that. Why are we now just starting to open up the doors to really understanding, you know, African history and African American history? You know, that's the part for me that is so difficult, you know, to really understand. But yeah, my sister is 4 years younger than me, and she just now found out about Juneteenth. Just graduated high school, you know. So I'm like, you trail this back now to when I was in school, and now you trail it back to where we are now. When are we going to really introduce this, you know? Because I think if it doesn't happen, you know, in the classroom, it ultimately needs to happen in, you know, in the household, you know. And I think that's, again, where uncomfortable conversations are had, but progressive conversations are had. That's where you really start to build these foundational principles of life. Mm-hmm. And that's where I feel like at times, sometimes these feelings of hatred start to arise because it's something missing, you know, something that may have triggered somebody, an individual, you know, past experience, you know, to a point where it's kind of hasn't gotten checked. It hasn't. And it constantly builds up to the point where now they may have this deep seated disgust or disliking for another person or for a concept or an idea. And that is why personally, I feel we have now gone so long with so many things that have gone unchecked. So we can talk about politics and how we express, we want these rulings to create change, and how in the first few weeks, yeah, okay, we're really making progress. And now what's being done, you know, what's really being done? We talk about, you know, for example, police reform, what's being done in terms, you know, in terms of educating officers who are, for example, working in inner city communities and building these relationships with the communities. You know, how are we bridging the two worlds, you know, so now we can kind of move together, you know, and hand in hand in a way. And it's not going to happen overnight. But at some point, when does the bridge start being formed? I don't feel like there's enough being done. You know, Juneteenth is just being introduced. But what about all these reforms and policies that we talked about prior to that have, you know, that have been discussed, but haven't gone anywhere.
And, so, you know, I think a lot of it, I was one to never have, you know, heard of Juneteenth until last year. Right. So I think I've had a phenomenal education, as good as one can have, never heard of it. And, you know, then you look at the root. Why is, you know, some of these things really difficult to talk about? We don't want to bring up the past. We don't want to bring up, you know, how we treated people within this country and how we built this country off of people's backs. We don't want to talk about that.
Hundreds of years of
we've moved on from that. Like we that we weren't involved with that. So why should we have to talk about that? I think there's a lot that goes into it. You could go layer after layer after layer and break it down. But I think what I've learned over the past year and a half or so is that these conversations help us move forward.
Absolutely.
Because it is an awareness thing. It is a self-education thing. And a lot of the thing comes, a lot of these instances where that we see, you know, injustices and it's really down to just being ignorant.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's not knowing you're ignorant and or just guilty by association. But the more we're aware, and we talked about it with Robbie Rogers, Colin yeah. Martin, you know, people that are dealing with it when it comes to in the locker room. Can I be myself? Can I come out to my teammates? Well, if people are aware of how to speak in a locker room and how to talk and what's acceptable, what's not acceptable, well, guess what? People are going to feel a lot more comfortable being who they are and not hiding hiding anything from their brothers within the locker room, coaches, fans. So I think like we're talking about now, there are so many parallels because people always have to fight for equality, fight for inclusion, fight for opportunity. The more we can talk about these things, the more we come together as one. And it's all about humanity. This isn't a political thing, which I think a lot of people like to get that caught up into politics. And as soon as you talk about something that's controversial or makes you feel uncomfortable, you're like, oh, yeah, that's politics. We don't talk about politics. And I deal with it on a professional level as well. You know, just certain companies, they're like, we don't want to talk about it because we're not a political company. Well, this isn't political. It might get tied into politics, but this isn't political. This is humanity. This is about just treating people with respect.
Exactly.
So, I love how you're on the forefront for this generation currently, and that you are a fantastic role model. And you know, you're going to be the role model to my kids as well, right? Because they're 5-year-old boys want to play soccer. They're going to be looking up to you, and you're somebody that I'm like, man, I'm proud that. You know, here we go, Uncle.
I better see recent Dakota rolling around in McKenzie U.S. national team jerseys. Send that Gank jersey over too.
I told him he owes me a jersey, so I'm waiting for that.
Wow.
No, Charlie, we meant kids jerseys, not for you.
Not you, for your children. Kids, man.
I'm saying I got to throw myself into that.
I mean, look, he just teased something there. Charlie did. We did talk to Robbie Rogers and Colin Martin yesterday. That interview is going to come out next week. And I think it's one that you'll really look forward to, everybody listening right now. It is extremely powerful. It's emotional. It's tough to listen to at times, but there's a lot of important messages for us in there. Mark, I want to get to so much more with you. And one of the things is that the Orange Slices podcast, like, I don't know many players in your position at the level that you play with some of the scrutiny that you're under that would choose to be a part of a project like this. Tell me why that was something you wanted to do. Like, what is it? What does it represent for you in your life?
Yeah, I think it's a new environment for me to kind of be myself, you know, to find my voice. I think that it's allowed me to step into a new industry where I'm learning, you know, the nuances of what it's like to be behind the mic, you know, on the other side, you know, as a host, as somebody directing the conversation, you know. I think that's, you know, it's been interesting to me, you know, and it's allowed me to tap into a new side of, you know, my mind, you know, a creative side. You know, how do I have this conversation? How do I direct conversations? How do I ask questions? How do I transition the conversation to a new, you know, area? You know, what are these different tactics that I can use? And, you know, it's helped me, you know, build that side of myself, where now off the pitch, I can have conversations with people, you know, and I think it's helped me, you know, in a tremendous way, but also allowed me to tap into things that I don't necessarily get to talk about, you know, in interviews and whatnot, because I have to give the poignant answers. And of course, when you're currently, you know, a footballer, it's different because you can't talk about things to the same depth, you know, and the same level of detail as you would is if you're not playing anymore, you know, that's, it's different, you know, but it's kind of given me the platform to speak up on things that, you know, for example, the justice, you know, reform, all these different topics, you know, what it's like to be on the pitch. you know, and compete with guys, you know, different stories that I've gone through, and then building that connection with guys who have also played, you know, and guys and their experiences and how things have changed and evolved. So it's been fun in that sense, because I also get to connect with people who I probably wouldn't have connected with if I didn't have the platform of the podcast. So, yeah, it's been great, you know, and I'm looking forward to continue with it more and continuing to find my voice as a host, you know, as having my own podcast. And yeah,
you guys did a great job. I just saw you did 96 minutes with Charlie.
Yeah.
Good Lord. I mean, does this man have anything
else?
It's
not hard, dude. It's one question.
I thought he had like, yeah.
Mark came in with one question, and then an hour and a half later, you just show up, and Charlie's still talking.
He's just finishing it off.
Listen. Look, credit to Chuck. Look, he went in detail on an emotional story, you know? And I appreciate, you know, him coming on the pod and having, you know, the comfort to share something, you know, the intimacy with us, you know, and I listen. So Chuck's always been, you know, a guy I've looked up to just in terms of, you know, him as a footballer, but him as a person as well, you know, the joy he brings to the environments that he's in, the fun that he has, you know, that's what I ultimately, you know, want to do as well, you know, and wherever I'm at, you know, always carrying a smile, because you never know how much a smile will do for somebody else, you know, so.
It's all relationships.
I was going to say, Mark, I'm not surprised. I think you were 19 playing in the MLS homegrown game. I went down to do interviews. And I've never had a player take the mic from me and then just go interview all the other players. And you were better at it than anyone else I work with. And I was like, okay. And they were like, all right, so now we'll do the thing. I was like, just use that. That was better than everything we're going to get. So it seems like you've been trained for this for a while.
No,
just swing it. At least you got something out of the Wake Forest experience, right?
Nice. Some ACC rivalry. Wake Forest has won 5 national championships. Charlie's school hasn't been to a tournament.
Look, you're lucky, Charlie. You look. I didn't even get to get a chance to participate in the Boston College game. You know, I got hurt that game. So
I
did participate. You know, I was been the first to hop on the mic. Yo, shout out my guy Chuck. You know, he came here. You know, shout out Bedoya as well. You know, you guys, you know, we just came through with BBC. Now we're about to fly home with a dub in our pocket.
Oh my God. any big game, Charlie's talking about how he was injured too. So I don't need you guys' ACC injury stories. Good Lord. You guys are just sitting on the bench with Knox all the time. Let's finish with this. Life at Genk. You were working your way into the team, but if I'm correct, I think you started the last 3 games. You guys made an insane run up that playoff table. You started with the least points of anybody, and you ended tied at the very top, got a Champions League spot. Walk us through your progression at Genk, getting there, feeling out where you were in the hierarchy, and then earning your way in.
Yeah, you know, came in. At that point, you know, I think it was like end of December. I wasn't really sure when I would get there. And I think because of COVID, they had continued playing through the winter. So I had to stay fit in order to really try and take a role in the team going into January. And they were first and whatnot. So got there. And then it was just training. One of the guys went down. Center backs went down. And then played my first match against Rouge. We played a few matches. We ended up losing that match. But we played, I think, probably like another 7 matches that month. Between mid-January or beginning of January and end of January, and I played maybe 5 or 6 of them. But the team just wasn't playing collectively, you know, as a unit. And we had a lot of adjustments, moving parts, moving pieces, you know, the manager pulled, you know, put guys in different positions, you know, trying to find the right combination. And ultimately, it was just about guys buying in to do their jobs on both sides of the ball. And ultimately, I was out of the 11, probably like played the cup match against St. Thurin, and I think that kind of sparked us and sent us. But I hadn't started a match probably from mid-February through April 4th or 5th, you know, and going through that period there where it was like, I'm in a different country now, just finally got settled in. Now I'm not playing. You know, the team went through a difficult stretch, went from being in first place to dropping to fourth place. You know, in a span of a few weeks, it just like what was going on. You know, I'm away from my family. You know, national team camp is coming up. Am I getting called into this camp? Mm-hmm. You know, this would be my first opportunity to be with the guys in Europe. You know, I make the jump for this reason to compete, and now I'm not able to really play. I'm training every day. You know, I'm busting my back trying to stay fit. You know, and it's like a grind. You know, each day. And get through the window, don't get called in. That was difficult. And then finally get through that. And I think one of the center backs was suspended for the upcoming match in April. So preparing myself for that, you know, kind of like getting back into it. Like, hey, your opportunity is coming up. You do well with this, your other opportunities will arise. So prepare yourself. We did well with that. We won, you know, but we were on a stretch at that point in time as well of having, I don't think we lost a match in March. You know, so if something's not broke, you're not going to fix it, right? So I don't – look, as a footballer, it's tough because you want to be playing all the time, but you also understand you got a routine, you got a team that's playing in form. You want to keep it moving, keep it going with that. So that was tough. And then, again, we were winning, so that it helped. And ultimately played the game April. And then the Cup semifinal against Anderlecht, you know, got a center back to red card coming off the bench, you know, in the 75th minute of that game, we're up 2-1, you know, and trying to close the match out. And then we have the Cup final, coming to the Cup final to close the match out, win that game. We step into the playoff and still not really in the 11. And then ultimately step in probably the fourth game in, come off the bench, play. And then, yeah, we go on a tear. You know, I think we had lost one match in the last 3 months of the season. You know, that was the last match to Antwerp. So to end the season with a trophy, you know, in Europe, you know, to end the season tied on points to help qualify for a Champions League spot, you know, I think these are all highs for me. You know, that kind of it showed me, you know, where I developed in a sense, you know, where I'd gone through the 6 months and it was tough, but you came out on the better side for the work that you put in, for staying and trusting, you know, trusting yourself, trusting the process, grinding each day, you know, all those ups and downs to live in, you know, and playing in Europe. You stay level-headed, you stay, you know, humble through it all. You'll thank yourself for it on the other end. So
can you talk to the listeners about how competitive it is in trainings? Because you were at Philadelphia Union. It's probably as competitive as it gets in Major League Soccer. But then when you go overseas and you're not in England, you're not in France, but you're in a competitive league with a team that's going to be competing in Europe, every day you're playing for your meal. You're playing for for a paycheck. You're playing for that starting 11 every single day. You could train great three days out of the week. If you train poor one day, that might be the day that coach says, all right, I'm playing with someone else. Can you tell them?
He can't even call it soccer. He's got to be a footballer and everything's football all of a sudden just to stay in the team. Otherwise, you get kicked out of the team.
Yeah. I mean, talk about that. If you get kind of caught in the wrong situation where you get out, they win, players keep that spot, and then they go on that run. Now you're on the bench for a month or two.
Yeah, it's a different level. Yeah, Philly was difficult because look, you're fighting each day, but at the same time, there's a level of comfort. You come up in the club, you know your abilities, this, that, and the other. But you step into a new environment. You step into Europe, where everybody is fighting for a spot. Everybody on a weekly basis, the team isn't selected yet, right? So when you step into the training environment, you got to put your best foot forward every single day. You know, it's the attention to the details, you know, and even if it may not be the cleanest of sessions, the intensity has to be there. If you're not intense, if you're not winning your duels in training, if you're not clean, you know, on connecting your passes, if you're not focused in certain moments where we're doing tactical drills, these are things that the coaches, you know, and there's four coaches there for a reason. So although the head coach may be sitting on the sideline, you know, kind of observing the entire practice, you got two assistants next to you, you got one assistant on the far side. So you got eyes on you at all points of time, all points, you know, of you and at any point in time. So I think that was I wouldn't say a big adjustment because I've always had the mentality of fighting, you know, for what I want, you know, but it's a different level. And it takes an adjustment period, you know, to get used to that. For me, it's a couple of weeks to really step in and, you know, going through that again, month and a half where I wasn't playing was a prime time for me to really learn if I was built, you know, forward playing, you know, at that level and in Europe. And I'm, you know, again, Belgium isn't the top five league, but it's right there, you know. And I think it deserves a lot more respect than people will give it because you got some top players who come out of the country, who also out of the club. So, yeah, it's one of those things where you cannot get complacent at any point in time because at that point you will get ousted and you better have the fight to work your way back into the team or else you will not play for the rest of the season potentially. So, yeah.
The champions.
I can't sing at all. That was horrible.
That was absolutely. We'll end here.
I had to try it. I had to go for it. I kind of went weak with it, though. I didn't really, like, I didn't project the way I should.
I would expect you to go all the way.
Sorry, I thought my own tone. I was trying to go too high and match the, like, opera style of it. We'll leave you on that one, Mark. What is that? When you hear that song, when you think about that opportunity, that has to just make you smile, man. That's what it's all about.
It's the dream, man. You know, Eddie, the football is just, man, it gets me amped up, you know, just thinking about it, having the opportunity to play in Champions League, you know. Like, it's not a Champions League final, but hearing that anthem is what you dream about, you know, as a footballer. And having played, you know, Christian was just with us and explained his experience in playing in a Champions League final and the build-up to it and all the work that went into that and that entire journey. That like gives me goosebumps, you know, talking about it, because it's, you know, yes, you amped up, you know.
You better be wearing the right kicks for that match. I'll tell you.
Listen, I got my kicks. Don't worry. We had a mean discussion. We'll get to that in a second. But the Champions League, is like it's the pinnacle of club football, right? And that's what you want to take part in, and not to have the opportunity to take part in it. You know, we have two teams we play in qualification, I should say. Mm-hmm. But the anthem's coming on just the same, you know, and it's going to be a fight, you know, because everybody wants to get in the group stages to compete, to get into the spot, to win the trophy. The
champion! I was going to say, somebody got to pee. There was. Somebody had to try it. Yeah, you came with the right energy with it.
Yeah,
you hit that note. I appreciate that. Mark, Anders is hitting us up saying, if you guys don't rap, we're not going to be able to finish the show. He's probably right. I usually never listen to him, but in this case, I think I got to. We appreciate your time, man. Good luck with everything. It's awesome to watch you sort of climb the ladder here and do your thing. And we're just glad to be observers on the journey.
No, I appreciate you guys. Thank you guys for having me. And make sure you wear the right kicks for the right occasion.
That's all you guys. That's good advice. Good advice. Leave him. Mark McKenzie. Appreciate you, man.
No, I appreciate you guys. Take it easy.
Big thanks to Mark for joining us. Always a joy to talk to him. Always a lot of smiles. Wishing him the best of luck, man. I'm never going to try to sing the Champions League anthem ever again in my entire life. So I can promise you guys that as well. Let's talk about MLS this weekend. National TV, you have, of course, that Q2 Stadium opening on Unimas. You've also got LAFC Houston Dynamo right afterwards on Unimas. You have a double header there, as well as some incredible MLS Live on ESPN Plus games. LAFC Houston, though, Dave, you kind of said, would you say Houston is LAFC light at this point?
Yeah. Yeah. I think I've been saying that since the beginning of the season. They're not a team. Obviously, LAFC has Carlos Vela. They have Eddie Atuesta. They have Marc-Anthony Kay. They've got a ton of talent. But also, you look at a guy like Marc-Anthony Kay, and that wasn't what you would say about him when he came into that team. Right. So I think they're a team that, while they have a ton of talent, the sum is greater than the parts. And that's what Houston's trying to build. And it's, if we believe the way we play and we are cohesive and fully committed, we can outperform what people expect of us. And I think that's what you've seen from Houston. It hasn't been full all-out press. Everything's direct down the middle. It has been a fusion of trying to possess, trying to outplay teams, and also trying to press high and create opportunities. And I think Tab Ramos is taking that from the school of Bob Bradley and trying to build up the players he has and create opportunities. So I think it's really interesting the way they've built this team. I've said it since the beginning of the season. I think Houston's been one of the most entertaining teams to watch. It was a great matchup the first time we saw these two teams go against each other. So I think it's a good litmus test for where they stand now coming out of this international break.
And maybe nobody needed the break more than LAFC, just to get healthy, just to refocus. Will we see the sort of team that we thought we were going to get? That I thought we were going to get. I mean, LFC is an interesting spot.
Maybe I should get a counter that I can help this guy.
Exactly. The national TV game. We got to talk about it. But here's the thing for me that I've thought about a lot with them is that their championship timing was screwed up by COVID, and everybody was screwed up by it, right? But this was a team that was built to win last year. And it just, everything went to pot for them, whether it be injuries, whether it be the conditions in the world. They are playing with a ticking timeline here, because you see the rumors around Diego Rossi. You see the one-year extension, no more, for Eddie Atuesta. You see Carlos Vela, who has a contract coming up as well and has had his injury issues. Like, this is the time. They need to go win something. I think they know that. So this is sort of another start for them after a long break. On Sunday, the national TV game is ESPN, Atlanta United, Philadelphia Union at 2 p.m. Eastern. As I said, that's sort of a Euro palate cleanser for you there. The Union are rolling. Atlanta is still scuffling. I think they have one win in five games or something like that. But I just want to say big congratulations to Jim Curtin on his contract extension. There's rumors, or they just said it, the clubs were after Ernst Tanner, after Chris Albright. When you build something good, when you start selling players, when those players have success in Europe and you have success as a club, these are the things that happen. But they got Jim Curtin locked in long-term here. Now, Charlie, ESPN Plus, your game of the week. Give us the pitch, baby. Eastern Conference, Giants, NYCFC, New England. Why should people watch this game?
I think for New England standpoint, they got the job done on the road against FC Cincinnati. Not the toughest opponent. They brought Jeff Cameron in, which made them a little bit stronger in the back. No doubt he will make them better defensively, but they still have so many players who are not up to par right now. And whether it's the structure, whether it's the tactics, whether they need to just get new talent, they haven't been great. But this New York City FC team has really performed. They have come together. Obviously, the loss against Columbus Crew, they were winning the match until Lucas Larrion had two brilliant free kicks. But they just came off of a road win against LAFC. That was impressive. They go down a man, and they still win. They came down a goal to get back in the game. They lose a man, and they still got the 3 points on the road. For New England, can they go to New York and beat New York City FC, who seems like they're moving on up as a team? The number nine position needs to get solved for New England. Is it Gustavo Bowe or is it Adam Buxa? And if it's not Gustavo Bowe, can he get going playing from the left wing position? Because not only do you have to get goals from him, but he has to defend. Since Carlos Hill has played the number 10 position, they've looked dangerous in every aspect, every phase of the match. But defensively, the two defensive midfielders, or the two midfielders who are playing alongside Carlos Hill behind him, need to be better in the defensive transition moments throughout the game. So I think for the Revs, that's where they need to improve. And for New York City FC, if you want to prove that you're going to be a contender in the Eastern Conference, then you have to win this game.
East Coast bias continues. I'm going to take Toronto-Orlando Saturday at 7:30 p.m. Eastern, I believe. Yep, on MLS Live on ESPN Plus. Daryl Dike's back. He's wearing purple. They're putting out hype videos of him running around in drills. I mean, I think we're going to see him play. He's going to play for Orlando City, and you better believe I'm not going to miss a second of that. On the flip side, Toronto FC are in a weird moment as a club. I mean, whether it be with all the COVID stuff, whether it be with Josie, this transition to Chris Armas, all of it just seems a little bit discombobulated right now. So Daryl Dike, and then what are Toronto FC going to be? Can they push through this moment? I want to see all of that, and I think it's going to be on display. I hope Daryl gets a start. I don't know if he will. Kind of seems like he'd probably come off the bench. But any MLS minute that Daryl Dike plays, I will be watching from here on out. And now, Dave, you going to keep us East Coast? You going to go away? ESPN Plus Game of the Week on your side.
You know I'm a man of the people. I am the only one here as you guys sit in your ivory towers of books and vegan toast just and all the things and books. Charlie's white sneakers because he doesn't get dirty ever and living on the top.
How are your fingernails,
I'm out
Charlie?
Here with the people.
Dirty or
exactly.
No?
Exactly. Cuticles over here.
Yeah, just
cuticles 101 for Charlie Davies. So I'm picking the Portland Timbers.
Stop it. I'm out here mulching. And you're talking about what?
Charlie's used more wheelbarrows than you've seen in your
whole
life.
Acre, your whole 2 acres of private land over there.
I'm out here mulching and gardening and putting in work, so I don't want to hear about clean fingernails and white shoes.
So yeah, I've got Portland SKC 10:30 p.m. Eastern time on Saturday night. I think these are two of the top three teams in the West if they're able to get their pieces together and get going. So as we talk about coming out of these breaks, where does Busio line up consistently? And yep, you've got a potential big Gold Cup coming up for SKC in that they could lose Alan Pulido. They could lose Busio. So you want to try and get points together now. And on the flip side for Portland, feels like Larice Mabiala could be back now. That's a big piece for them along the backside. And you're starting to build towards, you hope, Sebastian Blanco being available. So a lot of pieces that could be coming back into the team. And I think this could set the tone going forward for these two sides.
Yeah, full coverage of the week at MLSsoccer.com. Of course, on Monday, we will be here, and we will not have any guests. We've had a number on this show, and we'll have one more, but we'll really break it all down as MLS comes back this weekend. Let's get the lowdown, though, on what you're going to see on these jerseys. In celebration of Juneteenth, from Friday through Sunday, every team is going to wear these commemorative numbers on the back of their jerseys. Those jerseys are going to come in a special box designed by the artist we're about to chat with, which is Israel Solomon. That box is incredible. We will send out images of it. It's truly beautiful. It's truly educational. It's powerful as well. And then all those jerseys are going to be signed, the game-worn ones, and then auctioned. So you'll have a chance to own these. And that's a really cool opportunity. We'll put out more information on that as well. But for now, let's hear about the process behind the design, behind the art from Israel Solomon. It's an AT&T 5G call to the field. We're going to Indianapolis, to Israel Solomon, who designed these awesome numbers you see on the back of the MLS kits in honor of Juneteenth this weekend. They come with an incredible box. All the players are getting them. They're going to sign them. They're going to wear them. Then they're going to be auctioned off. It's a project we're really happy about. And we're also happy to be talking to you, Israel. This is incredible. I checked your art out, man. I saw the numbers. I was like, hold on. Let me see what he's doing. Congratulations on the project and congratulations on everything you accomplished. It's beautiful.
Oh, Andrew, thank you very much. It's much appreciated. I'm so happy to be linked up with Major League Soccer and Black Players for Change. And to be able to produce this work is just an honor to me.
So tell us how it started, what the process was like, and how you want people to see or how you think people might see the end product on the jerseys, but also, as I said, on this box, which we'll tweet out so you can all see. It's really a work of art.
Yeah, it's wonderful. You know, I'm so happy to be able to collaborate with MLS and BPC for this. So the way that this project started is I linked up with Ray Gaddis, and Ray Gaddis had been following me on Instagram, and I follow him as well, over the last few years. And, you know, I post my work. That's what I mainly use my Instagram for, is just to post progress images, post my work and things of that nature. And Ray, from time to time, would reach out to me and tell me I'm doing great work and keep up the good work and just being extremely positive. And a couple of months ago, Ray linked up with me and wanted to have a phone conversation. And, you know, I was all for it. He said that he had, you know, a potential opportunity that I could work on. I know that he does a lot of great work here in the Indianapolis area. So I'm like, yeah, I'm all for it. I definitely would, you know, be willing to work with you on a cool project. So Ray passed my work over to Major League Soccer and Black Players for Change. And it just so happened that Major League Soccer and Black Players for Change is working on this project to commemorate and celebrate Juneteenth. They saw my work and they thought that it would be a great fit. And Justin Morrow was also in that contact as well. So the first individual that I spoke with outside of Ray Gaddis was Justin Morrow, who is the executive for Black Players for Change. And, you know, he expressed his sentiments about my work and, you know, he was into what I do and he was attracted to my work as well. And he is the one who introduced me to the Juneteenth Project. And, you know, they were both organizations were interested in what I do. And we had a meeting probably about a month ago or so. And, you know, we talked about the project, what the vision was, what the goal was. And that's how things got started. So, you know, just through those circumstances, you know, I became attached to this project. So one thing I would say, especially for individuals who are artists or are looking to grow as artists, is you never know who's, you know, paying attention and who's looking at your work. So, you know, you always want to try to present your best work because there could be people from all across the world, all across different avenues, you know, that are looking at what you're doing. So once we got together and we had that meeting, there were discussions about, you know, what the work should represent and what it should say. You know, and with me being an educator, I'm a former middle school art teacher, and I've had other opportunities in education as well, like the Children's Museum of Indianapolis. I understand the importance of education. You know, to me, in order to progress in any field, you have to have an open mind and you have to be willing to listen and learn. And I think that, you know, with this Juneteenth project, you know, it's a great opportunity for individuals to do just that. And it was a learning process for me too. And, you know, I'm definitely open to that. It was a very collaborative piece. So Black Players for Change, I spoke with a few players from that organization, as well as some individuals just within the MLS organization. And one of the things that I noticed immediately was everybody that I spoke to was extremely passionate. And they felt authentic to me and they felt intentional. So that let me know that, you know, I was going to be in good hands throughout this process. So it ended up being a piece for me that I felt I could educate with. And the numbers, the messaging on the numbers are very upfront. You know, it's celebratory. It says Juneteenth, 1865, celebrate freedom. However, the box that the numbers come in was that opportunity for the messaging, for the storytelling, and for, you know, the educational aspect. And, you know, with those things, we collaborated, and I think that the product came out very well. And I'm amazed by the work, and I'm just happy to be a part of this. And I'm glad that I feel that my art translated well to this project.
Well, one, I can say just getting a look at the design and the colors and just the scheme, I'm thinking this is incredible. This might be the best Juneteenth work I've seen. And I haven't seen too much Juneteenth work, maybe just a year's worth, to be honest.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I feel like for most people that I've come across, Juneteenth was really not prevalent. Not too many people I knew celebrated it. Not too many people I knew talked about it, were aware of it until George Floyd. And then people realized, whoa, we have to come together. And a holiday like this is what I think brings us back to how far we've come as a country, where we were, how can we celebrate Black history, but also not only Black history, Black culture, and where we are today, and how much work we still have to do, right? How much work is left to be done. When you look at your piece and your design, what strikes you most as far as that educational component? What are you trying to get across with your design?
Basically, what I wanted to get across was a sense of Black pride, for one, you know. So I decided that when I was creating the piece and doing my research, I noticed that a lot of work that was inspired by Juneteenth included the red, the black, and the green, which is the Pan-African flag. So, you know, I use a lot of bright and vibrant, bold colors in my work, light white, you know, white colors, light blues, pinks, oranges. But I wanted this to be significant and, you know, impactful in regards to the holiday. So what I wanted to do is I wanted to take those colors and I wanted to use those. I don't know the whole ins and outs of the flag. I'm not going to say that I know the complete history of the Pan-African flag, but I have a general understanding and like what the colors stand for as well. So, you know, the red representing the blood that was shed and lost in the fight for freedom, the black representing the black culture, us as a people, and then the green representing growth, the opportunity for growth and the growth that's been made as well. So, you know, I wanted those colors to be implemented into the design. And then inside of that, and, you know, along with BPC and Major League Soccer, I wanted to recognize freedom fighters as well. Throughout our history. And that's why, you know, we came up with having Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass represented, who were both abolitionists and, you know, fought to end slavery. And they also fought for other things as well, like Frederick Douglass and women's suffrage and things of that nature. So I wanted those educational pieces to be added into the work. And then finally, inside of the fist that's within the box, basically, I just wanted a really small historical wrap up of what it is that we're celebrating and we're talking about and we're thinking about. And that's kind of where the education came into play.
I love the image as well. And before I let you go, I need to get your perspective on it on the bottom of the box, which I think is interesting. It's very educational through that. But if you flip it over to the bottom of the box, and sometimes that hides from you, right? That's the image. And you can kind of see it behind my shoulder a little bit here. In Orlando at MLS's back, that long, you know, 9-minute moment of silence, that demonstration by Black Players for Change, their moment to really come out in the world and say, this is what we're about and this is what we're going for. When you did your research into that side of it in Major League Soccer and this movement by PPC, what struck you?
What struck me is that the organization BPC cares and MLS cares as well. And that's what I get from it, because for them to stand in unity, to bring across a message, you know, that's that poignant in a time like this, all organizations, sport organizations, companies, you know, different things across the country, they don't have to do that. Those are not things that have to be done. I felt that, you know, those things were intentional and they were honest and truthful. And, you know, that makes me feel good about being part of this project. And just the image alone of the players, you know, kneeling and standing in that protest with their fist up, it's very powerful. It's very impactful. And it says a lot. And one of the things that is on that box on the bottom where that image is a message stating own your voice. And that particular message came from Black Players for Change. Quincy, I don't want to mispronounce his last name, but
Ameriqua. Yep.
Yes. He was very, you know, he really wanted that message to stand out. And it resonated with me because being a former middle school teacher, one thing that I would try to tell my students is if you can't control your voice or who you are, then somebody else will, you know. So you have to be able to control your voice. You have to be able to own your voice. And, you know, ownership is important in other aspects of life, you know, if we want to grow as a people and grow our culture. So, you know, that it's an impactful piece altogether to me. And, you know, if I were to sit here and say that, you know, this was all my brainchild and I came up with the whole thing. No, it was not just me. It was a collaborative effort between myself, Black Players for Change, and Major League Soccer. And, you know, I appreciate them giving me this opportunity.
You just made it beautiful.
That's exactly. It. They didn't have the artistic talent, right? They had to bring in the vision. You were the vision, Israel.
I just put the shine on it.
Yeah, it's a good shine, man. It's a good shine. We look forward to seeing it on every single jersey this weekend. As I said, yes. These are going to be worn. They're going to be signed. They're going to be auctioned off. The player reps for BPC and all 27 clubs are choosing organizations in their cities to donate the proceeds of this auction too. So that'll be trickled out over the next couple of months. You can own one of these. And again, it's worn, it's signed, it's something really special. It commemorates history. And maybe most importantly, it's time to educate yourself if you don't know what we're talking about when we say Juneteenth. Israel, thank you so much for your time. Your work is amazing, man. Outside of this, I really love digging into what you're doing. Yeah. And best of luck in everything you do.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you, Andres. I appreciate this opportunity. You all have a great day.
Big thanks, Israel, for joining us. I think the start on those auctions for those jerseys is at $150. These are authentic, game-worn, signed jerseys. That feels like a deal to me. We'll see what the bidding is like. I might have to come in here for like a bench player or something just so I don't get into a bidding war, but I think I'm going to need one of those jerseys. We'll end it with the mailbag, 401-206-0MLS, extra time at MLSsoccer.com. Anders is going to kill us. Dave, give me one. Give me one good one just to finish on a good note.
We got a lot of good national team stuff, and one was, does Jackson Yuhl need to move from San Jose to avoid the Will Trapp career path? Feels like his USMNT career could be on a similar trajectory as Trapp if he can't find a way to step up in the next year or two.
I think that's a little unfair to both Will Trapp and to Jackson Yuhl, because I don't think either of them were in a place. This is like implying that they were sort of locked in, that if they didn't make the move, that it was over for them. Like, clearly, Greg has said, I'm going to give Jackson Yuhl opportunities. I believe in Jackson Yuhl. I don't think it's on him to have to move to get that. It's on him to have better performances with the national team. If he performs better with the national team, I don't think it'll matter, because Greg has also already shown, look, I believe in you in San Jose. So to me, it's just about national team performance. And if you can't live up at that level and do it at that level, inevitably the coach is going to have to go a different direction. That's just the way it works.
Okay, there you go.
Okay, well, there it is.
Anders allowed it.
He let it go. All right, that's it from us. Big thanks to our guests on this show, to Jorge Chavez of the Austin Anthem, to Mark McKenzie, who's always one of our favorite people to talk to, and Israel Solomon, whose work is incredible. Go check out his work outside of this Juneteenth project. It is really, really cool and beautiful. And big thanks to Ray Gaddis for hooking us up with him. All right, that's it from us. We'll see you on Monday, everybody. We'll be right back.